Searching for Whitetopia.
There is, I believe, an existential identity crisis in conservative white America that I saw firsthand in my journey throughout Whitetopia.
That's Richard Benjamin. We'll talk to him about his trip across the U.S., visiting white communities that are circling the wagons against an increasingly diverse America. And later in the show, we'll air an interview we did last year with Richard Michelson about his book for children, As Good as Anybody. It's about the friendship between Martin Luther King and Abraham Joshua Heschel. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. On the day this show is being produced, the eyes of the nation are on the special election being held tomorrow to fill the Senate seat vacated by Ted Kennedy. Democrat Martha Coakley is facing an unexpectedly stiff challenge from Republican Scott Brown. One group of voters supporting Brown against Coakley is Americans for Legal Immigration, which claims there's an illegal immigration crisis that's threatening our nation's very survival and identity, as they say on their website. Although the group claims to be diverse and multi-ethnic, the vast majority of anti-immigrant activists are white. They're part of a right-wing political wave sweeping a segment of white America that fears losing its privileged status as the population becomes more diverse. Many are holding up in enclaves that have found ways to keep out the dreaded other, communities my guest Richard Benjamin calls Whitetopias. Between 2007 and 2009, he went on a 26,000-mile journey throughout America, visiting some of the fastest-growing and whitest locales in our nation to find out what was going on in the minds and hearts of the residents. Benjamin, who's African American, has found that immigration has supplanted the black-white divide as the hot-button issue for whites. In fact, he says, we can no longer talk about race as a predominantly black-white issue in America. And, he says, we have to factor in issues of class as well as race. Benjamin is a senior fellow at the progressive think tank Demos and a member of the National Book Critics Circle. His book is Searching for Whitetopia, An Improbable Journey to the Heart of White America. I started out by asking how he defines Whitetopia.
Well, a Whitetopia has three traits. The first is that it has posted more than 6% population growth since the year 2000. The second is the majority of that population growth has come from white migrants. And the third is that it has an ineffable charm, a pleasant look and a feel to it. Many of these places often land on best places to live lists posted by venues such as CNN or Money Magazine. And so this charm is often expressed in beautiful natural resources, drop-dead gorgeous settings, I think of St. George, Utah, or Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, or at least a comfort to them, a neighborliness.
So they're really like communities, kind of like Leave It to Beaver communities.
Yes. In fact, in the book, I often refer to them as Wi-Fi'd Mayberries, because there's a lot of nostalgia to Whitetopia. People are imagining communities they grew up in as their child. And one of the most poignant remarks I heard in Whitetopia when I was on my journey is that a woman who had moved to St. George had said that the California of her youth was, quote, a little paradise, and that she could no longer find that except for in St. George.
In St. George, Utah. Now, what were you looking to find out when you went in search of Whitetopia? Why this journey?
I wasn't looking for anything. I went without any preconceived notions or any ideas as to what I would find.
Rich Benjamin, you're black. Why did you conceive this project to go in search of Whitetopia? What were the questions? You went without preconceived notions, but you must have gone with some questions.
I went with some questions in terms of how do these communities tick? What are they like? And I felt that I couldn't get the spirit or essence of a place without living there myself. because statistics can only tell me so much. And so that's what I went, is just to get a feel and a flavor of these communities. So I embedded myself in three of them for 3.5 to 4 months apiece: St. George, Utah, Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, and Forsyth County, Georgia.
Let's start with the one that was in Utah, St. George, Utah. It's called Utah's Dixie, which I think is a pretty descriptive name to give to it. You seem to fit in pretty well there.
Yes, I did. It was a lot of socializing. Sometimes when I look at my calendar that I kept, which is an old notebook, it's just jam-packed. I did a lot of golfing. I did some fishing. And I went to potlucks and demolition derbies and rodeos. But I also attended a lot of community meetings, meetings among local zoning boards, meetings among the Republican group, and a meeting of a group called the St. George Citizens Council Against Illegal Immigration.
And that was a big hot-button issue there. In fact, do you have a copy of the book there?
I do.
Wonderful. I wonder if you could turn to page 39.
Okay.
I'd like to ask you to read a section from this page. You're at a meeting of this organization that you just mentioned. Is this the Citizens Council on Illegal Immigration? Do I have the name correct?
Yes.
Okay. So you're there. Start with the air crackles with resentment and go down to the end of that section there.
Okay, we're at a meeting of the St. George Council Against Illegal Immigration, and a gentleman is explaining why he opposes illegal immigration. And like some of the organization's founders, he's in fact fled Southern California for Utah's Dixie. And the last thing I'll mention before reading this passage is, during the meetings, people would ask new attendees, well, have you been to Arizona? Have you been to Nevada? And if they said no, the leaders would say, well, now you don't know what you're in for, because we cannot let illegal immigration ruin St. George the way they allege it ruined places like Tucson and Phoenix. So here goes. The air crackles with resentment. It's that same ambient fury you feel in an airport lounge when the airline casually announces it's canceling your flight. Steve Swan suggests selling ICE, i.e. Immigration and Customs Enforcement t-shirts, at the Dixie Fiesta with H2O printed on the back. H2O, I whisper to my neighbor. I don't get it. Wetback, he says. The woman in front of me turns around and looks at me, a confused, pained look contorting her face. I stare at the back of her husband's neck. Wrinkles form deep grooves in the rough-hewn, leathery, crimson skin like ancient gorges in the Red Canyon country. Looking closely at this square-inch landscape on the nape of his neck, I feel an absurd poignancy about this gathering. In this crowded room, in an empty public building, closed after business hours, flying the American flag, in this booming corner of southwestern Utah, the Citizens Council is anxiously staking its last stand against what amounts to a fait accompli across the country, diversity and globalization. This room feels more than full to me. It feels claustrophobic. I feel bunkered in with a crowd of determined white folks trying to pull up the drawbridge against an encroaching nation.
The name Citizens Council, for those of us who are old enough to remember the Civil Rights Movement, brings up memories of other citizens' councils in the South, which also were trying to hold back the tide of the Civil Rights Movement, in fact, a movement that did end up being able to win real legal rights, if not true economic rights, for African Americans as well as other minorities, so-called minorities, in this country. And as you point out, many of those minorities are now becoming majorities in certain places, but not in these places. How do you read this? One time, these citizens' councils were against African Americans. You, an African American, were now in this meeting. You were accepted, as far as I can tell, and the target had shifted.
Yes, yes. I think in many communities across this country, the fault lines and the frontier of race relations are between white Americans and Latino Americans, specifically immigrants. And that was one of the things that sort of took me off guard, is in many of these communities, the opposition to immigration. And part of the reason is that many of these folks grew up in communities that were either white or white and black, and now they're finding themselves among immigrants where they'd never imagined just a generation ago immigrants would be. Rural communities in Tennessee, rural communities in Utah, rural communities in Georgia, and even in the Pacific Northwest. And so a lot of the issues that I dealt with, especially in Utah, had to deal with immigration.
And if you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Rich Benjamin about his new book, Searching for Whitetopia. You say there's a Latino time bomb. First of all, why do you call it that, and what is it?
To me, the Latino time bomb expresses the explosive emotion that Latino immigration triggers. And we saw this when Joe Wilson stands up in the well of the United States Congress and tells the president, "You lie." Some Americans might have been surprised by that episode, but having spent 2 years in Whitetopia, I was not, because a lot of community members in Whitetopia feel fed up because they feel their taxes are going wasted to educate immigrants, to give immigrants health care and social services and the like. And so I call it the Latino time bomb, because by 2042, white people will no longer be the American majority, and that is in large part due to the fact of A, Latino immigration, but B, higher birth rates among Latinos than every other ethnic group in America. And so it definitely has this trigger effect and this idea, this sense of a deadline. What will happen by 2042?
Now, you say taxes. I mean, is it really true then that our taxes are going to go to supporting all, or do go to supporting all these immigrants? I mean, in the book, you have a pretty surprising statistic about who really does benefit from our taxes.
First, it must be pointed out that immigrants, undocumented and not, do pay taxes. They pay consumption taxes. In other words, anytime they buy anything in this country, they are paying a tax. So I think we should mention that. Obama's health care plan and the Democratic plans being floated in the Senate will not subsidize health care for undocumented immigrants, no.
Or even like in Massachusetts, there was a provision that did not allow for even legal immigrants. Now that some of that money's been restored, but by no means all of it.
Yes, that is correct. And it varies by state and by municipality.
And they pay taxes.
They do pay taxes. And I think that there's a lot of confusion about that in America, because I literally hear they are welfare mooches sitting in the wagon, whereas hard-working, free, tax-paying Americans have to pull that wagon, when in fact, all immigrants pay taxes in some form or another.
So who is getting the bulk of the tax, the benefit from taxes in this country?
Well, the book points out a discrepancy. Diverse, immigrant-rich states like California, like New York, like New Jersey, and like Massachusetts pay a disproportionate share of taxes to Uncle Sam than they get back in federal services, whereas the more monolithic states like Montana or Wyoming or Utah pay fewer federal taxes to Uncle Sam than they get in return.
So the
idea that states where you have inner cities or big cities or big populations of immigrants are welfare cheats that are sucking off the federal government is just not true statistically.
Now, when you talk about these welfare cheats, this is an old trope. And again, this was a trope that we heard back in the day that used to be applied to African Americans. Now, you say this Latino immigration is disrupting the old script on race and poverty. What do you mean by that?
More and more, when you throw out a stereotype about what is race and poverty, it's changed, it's shifted. Many Americans no longer see that welfare queen chewing gum and eating potato chips at 9 a.m. instead of going off to work like the rest of hardworking Americans, quote-unquote. Now, the idea of race and poverty in America includes Latinos. It includes El Barrio. It includes immigrants. And that was part of a lot of the fascinating conversations I had in these Whitetopia communities, is that folks would say, hey, Rich, you know what? In 20 years, that Latino immigrant is not going to want to be flipping burgers. He is likely to be a drug dealer. And so concerns about gangs, drug dealing, and violence were prevalent among Whitetopian communities. And in that passage I just read, what had just been discussed is a feared gang migration from Phoenix, Arizona, or from Las Vegas, Nevada, up until St. George, Utah.
Now, one of the questions that occurred to me as I was reading your book, Whitetopia, and I'm speaking with the author, Rich Benjamin, was how much of this is race and how much of this is class? I know that there are people that I've talked to in this community. We have two communities here that have very large so-called minority communities that might, in fact, become majority communities in the not-too-distant future. Springfield and Holyoke, they have a good number of undocumented workers as well. And I have heard people say the undocumented workers are undercutting wages for the working class. So this is a tangled ball of wool here to sort out. How much is race? How much is class? How do we approach these two issues?
They're so intertwined that most times you cannot cut them out neatly. In other words, wanting to be among one's own is as much a class issue as it is a race issue. But unfortunately, because we often imagine poor people to be brown, it becomes a race issue. But I should mention on the topic of classes, I learned a lot that there can even be class divides among white people. And so in those instances, class is not a race issue. For example, in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, one afternoon I had been hanging out with this guy named Ed, you know, wonderful guy. And ultimately, I learned that he does not live in a regular home like you and I, but he rents a storage unit because he can't afford to rent a house or an apartment in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. That very afternoon, I went to this sprawling estate of cattle barons, and they were having a meet and greet for U.S. Senator Mike Crapo, and Mike Crapo promised the intimate gathering more tax relief. So even among white people, you'll have class differences. And for me, one of the most poignant lessons of Whitetopia is that working class whites and poor whites themselves often can't afford to live in these communities. And they told me to my face, you know, Rich, we won't be able to raise our children in the very communities we grew up in, especially because of this influx of new money.
And on the other hand, you, as at least a middle-class black person, were accepted into these communities. You could play on the same polo field, so to speak. So there, it wasn't so much race, it was class.
Are you suggesting that the acceptance of me was class-based?
To a certain degree, yes.
I think that's fair. I absolutely think that's fair.
Now, you talk about how pleasant these places are. You also talk about research showing that people are actually more secure and engaged in homogeneous communities, you know, so that in some way this does not bode well for diverse communities. Putting this within the context of the larger American life. Do you think that this is something that is just, you know, in human nature, or is this something that is really determined by the kind of society we live in? And if so, how could that be changed?
It's a fascinating question, and I don't at all think it's part of human nature, and I reject that argument. And folks would tell me, you know, Rich, birds of a feather flock together. It's just biology for us to want to be together. And I have to point out the actual decisions that are made that segregate this country. For example, the way houses are built, the way zoning is enforced, the way and how and where highways are built. For example, if you zone a community in such a way that every house can only be built on a 1-acre lot, then of course you're going to have a segregated community. When you say that renters are not welcomed, or you're declining to build affordable housing, then of course the community is going to be segregated. And county officials told me that to my face. One county official said, you know, I wish we could allow apartment complexes. I wish we could improve our zoning so that we could attract more firemen and policemen and teachers to come teach in our community. He said, but our community will remain zoned like this because that's how the residents prefer it. So it requires a lot of backbending, backflips, and social engineering to keep this country segregated, and it's not just a magical part of human nature.
Mm.
It's a lot of hard work, in other words.
Right, right, exactly. A lot of these communities are ex-urban communities, as you call them, and I want to get back to the idea of ex-Serbia, which I'm just kind of introducing here. But before we get to that, you actually went to a very urban Whitetopia, unlike Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, or unlike Utah's Dixie, and that was Carnegie Hill or the Upper East Side in New York City. New York has a very high level of racial segregation, and this neighborhood in particular. What perpetuates that?
A lot perpetuates segregation. Carnegie Hill, as you mentioned, is a little enclave in Manhattan. Manhattan is a polyglot city teeming with different races, but you have Carnegie Hill, a neighborhood that is 91% white as Idaho, smack in the middle of Manhattan. And the way you have a place like Carnegie Hill is its residents, by the way, who overwhelmingly voted for Obama, preserve the community in such a way that it preserves its demographic makeup. And that happens by zoning laws. They zone to quote-unquote preserve historical preservation. They zone to zone out certain types of inclusionary zoning, certain types of affordable housing. And another way that happens is that Carnegie Hill is full of co-ops, which is a pretty unique urban phenomenon where residents of a building get to vote on who can buy property in that building. And Carnegie Hill is overwhelmingly made up of co-ops. And here in New York, these co-op boards are infamous for being finicky about who they let in. And the problem with co-op boards is that they don't have to publicly disclose why they didn't let you in. And so there's no sort of oversight as to whether fair housing laws and discrimination laws are being enforced. Let's say there's me. I'm a black man. I want to buy a co-op in Carnegie Hill. I've proven that I qualify financially to buy into this building. What I got to do is I have to be interviewed by the co-op board, which is like a homeowners association on steroids. So they've picked apart my finances. My finances meet the muster, but there's a social element to the interview. Now, if they reject me, I have no way of knowing why they reject me. Is it because I'm not married? Is it because I'm married? Is it because I have 8 kids? Is it because I have no kids? Is it because I'm black? Is it because I'm not black? More importantly, forget about race. Is it about class? Have I gone to the right school? Did my parents go to the right school? do I vacation in the right place? Do I winter in the right place? Do I summer in the right place? Do I belong to the right tennis club? Do I belong to the right golf club? No way of knowing. And it's funny because I posed as a home buyer to try and buy a co-op apartment in New York City, and I got all kinds of weird questions sideways that weren't explicitly asked, but they were made in the conversation chit-chat that happened when I was shopping for a home. And so clearly, realtors are sussing you out, and it's no longer about skin color strictly. It is about all those questions I mentioned that have a way of popping up in the home buying process in that neighborhood.
And that, leads to many, many more white people just because a disproportionate number of white people have moved in the circles that are accepted in there. But as you say in the book, there was a very elegantly dressed black woman that you met in the elevator of one of those buildings who told you how nice the people were in the building. So in some way saying, yeah, you could live here too.
Yes, but that's a function of how she's dressed and how I'm dressed and how I speak and how she speaks. But, you know, it's a pernicious effect because, you know, if one is an immigrant, if one is not an immigrant, there's just no way of enforcing fair housing laws in this city under those circumstances.
We're talking with author and political scholar Rich Benjamin about his book, Searching for Whitetopia, An Improbable Journey to the Heart of White America. Now to excerpts. You go to Forsyth County in Georgia. It's an exurb of Atlanta, and Atlanta is, after all, a city that has a very large, well-to-do and middle-class African-American community, but Forsyth is not like that. It's a Whitetopia. Tell us, first of all, describe Forsyth to us, and then I'd like you to tell us the backstory and how exurbs got to be some of the fastest-growing areas of the United States.
Okay. I'll start by describing what Forsyth is like. Forsyth, I felt, was like an awkward teenager growing up at a moment where it's not sure what it is. Is it a suburb? Is it still country? Is it still rural? On the one hand, it feels like a suburb in the sense that you do see suburban traffic. You do see tons of Starbucks and chain outlets. But on the other hand, it still has a lot of country charm. I went to a lot of country restaurants, got my fried gumbo and biscuits. And in many cases, neighbors still know your name, and families have been there for 2, 3, 4 generations. So Forsyth can perhaps be described as having country living with suburban perks. In other words, you still hear the Bob quail at night, but you still can get a great latte.
And you said that exurbs like Forsyth were part of even a political shift, a shift in the political landscape, a shift in the South from being Democratic to being Republican. This is a very interesting backstory. I wonder if you would kind of, you know, briefly tell us what your idea on this is.
Sure. For listeners who aren't familiar, picture a series of rings. At the center ring, you have a city. At the next ring, you have an inner suburb. At the next ring, you have an established suburb. At the next ring, you have an emerging suburb. And at the outer ring, you have an exurb, which is farther from the city. Now, part of this book is about white flight. So first, there was flight from the city. Then inner suburbs, as we all know, have been getting browner and browner, often with immigrants. And so that brings many white residents to the furthest frontier. Not simply race, but also declining house prices and house bargains and wanting a more quiet life have brought folks to the exurbs. One of the reasons George Bush was reelected in 2004 is because the Republicans did their homework and they realized that the new votes to be had were in the exurbs. And so while Democrats, particularly John Kerry, was beating old Bushes and hunting trampled ground for votes, Bush went to the exurbs, and he had extremely sophisticated campaign techniques in the exurbs, often through churches. And, you know, Republicans will tell you it's no secret that the exurbs are more conservative than the inner suburbs. In other words, the inner suburbs basically are cities. When you look at the closest suburbs to Boston or the closest suburbs to Chicago or L.A. or New York, they're really mere appendages of the city. In fact, many inner suburbs also have high-rise condos. They have more liberal views on traditional issues, maybe abortion and gun control and gay marriage. But the exurbs are where you have more conservative folks.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with scholar Richard Benjamin about the overwhelmingly white enclaves he calls Whitetopia. Between 2007 and 2009, he went on a 26,000-mile journey throughout the heart of white America and into some of the fastest-growing and whitest locales in our nation. Stay tuned for more of our interview after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with Richard Benjamin about his book, Searching for Whitetopia, An Improbable Journey to the Heart of White America. Okay, so then we have Obama is elected. He's not white. He's African-American, at least partially. And explain that, because he won, I mean, after all, he had to win among whites as well as among blacks, even though there was a lower vote than among, you know, he had to win a significant portion of the white vote, and he won in communities and areas like Iowa that were overwhelmingly white. So explain this phenomenon. If Whitetopia is overwhelmingly GOP, How come Obama won?
It's a fascinating question. I think Obama ran under the most favorable conditions any 20th or 21st century candidate could run under, i.e. a very unpopular party, a tanking economy, and two global wars. And on top of that, Obama being a brilliant man and a very capable candidate. So there's that. As you point out, Obama lost the white vote, but that's not surprising. Most Democratic candidates lose the white vote. So Obama was able to win in certain pockets of this country and through certain states without winning the majority of the white vote. And so
He still won among whites. I mean, in other words, even if overall he didn't win the white vote, I mean, his first big win was Iowa. Those are white folks.
Yes, it's possible. He won several predominantly white states, from Iowa to Colorado, without winning the white vote nationally.
And why? I mean, you say there was something about Obama that, not just that he was, after all, you know, he was lucked out in terms of the conditions, but also that he ran in a certain way not to excite white prejudices.
Yes. I mean, Obama's smart. His advisors are very capable. His chief advisor, David Axelrod, is known as a, quote, crossover specialist. In other words, David Axelrod knows how to make... Let's put it this way. David Axelrod knows how to help black candidates put their best foot forward to be most appealing to the most amount of white voters. And Obama's done that cleverly. And also, we have to acknowledge that he presented a plan that most voters of all races just found more appealing compared to Obama's predecessor.
And that really leads me into some other questions, because as you point out in the book Whitetopia, Rich Benjamin, you point out that Obama did this by appealing to the center, really, we could say, moving to the right. I'd say after he became president. Before he became president, he had a lot more progressive and liberal views. And there's a contradiction here, because on the one hand, you can look at national polling on a whole range of issues. Comes to mind most clearly to me is health care reform, where you actually have majorities who are in favor of the public option and even of Medicare for all, according to a poll by the Kaiser Foundation that they did in July. Often, the voters are more progressive than the politicians. And Obama appealed to white voters as well as non-white voters because of his platform, which was by and large a progressive platform. Yet since he's been in office, he's moved to the center. So how does this square with your idea that in order for non-white politicians to appeal to white voters, they have to appeal to the right or the center?
They do. I mean, they very much do, because you're not appealing to the population as a whole. You're appealing to who tends to turn out at the polls. And voters, or at least the voting public, is whiter than the country itself. Obama isn't appealing to American principle. He's appealing to likely voters.
So what I wonder is, I mean, there was an awful lot of rage, for example, against the bailout, which was done before Obama came in, but he certainly added a whole lot to it afterwards. This was extremely unpopular among white Republican voters, as well as among people who were white Democrats and non-white Democrats, let's say. We've had the white working class, as well as the working class in general, has been hammered by rising oil prices, falling wages, unemployment. The exurbs themselves, you know, some people say suburbia is going to come to an end because of peak oil and the rise in oil prices. I'm just wondering if your book might have been a snapshot in time that's already beginning to change. And I think you also ask the question, you say, is this a fact that, you know, the GOP has got a larger hold over the white voter, something that is going to really last, or is this a cement boots?
I don't think this is a snap of time. I think these are issues we're going to be dealing with for at least 10 years. For example, the Latino time bomb I speak about has to do with immigration, and we're going to be dealing with immigration reform in one way or another for the next 5 years. But I really appreciate and agree with your comment about the contradiction that we see in America. America is rife with contradictions. For example, a lot of the anger we've been seeing in the last 4 months, we see it with the tax protests. We see it with the angry healthcare town halls. We see it with the birther movement that says, is our president American? Is he legally qualified to lead us? We see it with Joe Wilson's outburst. Mr. President, you lie. Our tax dollars are going to go wasted on illegal aliens. There is, I believe, an existential identity crisis in conservative white America that I saw firsthand in my journey throughout Whitetopia, that later, in fact, came to be in all the events I just described. So we're going to have to see what's happened. I don't think anything's resolved, and I think it's unfolding before our very eyes.
Yeah. In many ways, your book is a conversation about race, with class being part of that. You actually say that the black-white divide bores you. I guess I'd like you to explain that in the light of what you talk about here, because really, this seems to be at the kernel of many of the contradictions that we're speaking of.
Well, you know, you'll hear the old school, you know, black race man minister say, you know, black and white, we're going to come together. And I just roll my eyes. That's so 20th century. 21st century race relations. First of all, Latinos are the largest minority, the largest racial minority in the U.S. So sometimes people will think about race relations literally in this black-white way, which is completely different from the lived existence that we see in our day-to-day lives. And so I am. I'm bored. I'm done with the black-white race relations. I'm not saying that black-white race relations are good or bad one way or the other. I'm just trying to look at race relations in a realistic, forward-thinking way.
And I really stand corrected. I think I fell into that conflation because really what you are talking about is how race lies at the kernel of so many of these contradictions in terms of voting with people, you know, white working class folks voting against their own interests. And even though I kind of feel that a lot of those teabaggers are really a tiny minority and don't represent most white people, you know, as you say, it's easy for white people to be split if you play the race card. So how do you think we're going to move beyond race in order to tackle the very real crises that are looming on our horizon?
It requires a challenge. And part of the reason is, for some people, race is an emotional issue. It triggers all sorts of emotional buttons. And so that's what we have to do. We have to move forward, and there are challenges to be tackled ahead of us.
And can we actually move beyond race without having a pretty in-depth conversation about it?
Yes, but the conversation has to be different. It can't be the same old conversations we've had in the last 20 years. You know, cliched ideas about multiculturalism, cliched ideas about diversity, cliched ideas about sensitivity training, guilt-tripping people, refusing to mention class in some instances. So I hope, moving forward, the conversation really reflects and speaks to what is actually happening.
Well, your book is Searching for Whitetopia, An Improbable Journey to the Heart of White America. It raises many more questions than it answers, but it's a fascinating read, and thanks so much for talking with us here.
Thank you, Francesca. Thank you for having me.
Richard Benjamin is a senior fellow at the progressive think tank Demos.
I'm on my way, I'm on my way, and I won't turn back. I'm on my way, won't turn back. I'm on my way, and I won't turn back. I'm on my way, great God, I'm on my whole freedom. Oh, the freedom over me. And before I'd be a slave, I'd be buried in my grave. I go home, I go home to my Lord. Be free.
Today we celebrate the birthday of Martin Luther King Jr. Richard Michelson's book for children, As Good as Anybody, recounts the story of the friendship between the Reverend Martin Luther King and Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel. Both men of religion and victims of discrimination, they worked together for peace and justice. They were together at the famous Civil Rights March in Selma, Alabama in 1965. Richard Michelson is a poet and children's book author in Northampton, Massachusetts. This interview first aired last year. Richard Michelson, welcome to Writer's Voice on this week of celebrating Martin Luther King Day.
An absolute pleasure to be speaking to you again.
This book is about Martin Luther King Jr. and Abraham Joshua Heschel, two really remarkable men with an extraordinary connection between them and extraordinary parallels. You start with their childhoods. We all know Martin Luther King, but I know I didn't know much about his childhood other than that he was a junior. So tell us a little bit about both of their childhoods, and why don't you start with Martin Luther King?
Well, you know, I have to admit that I didn't know much about the childhood either, and I didn't really know much about either King or Heschel's childhood. When I started this book, I really came at it from the point of view of that historic picture that I was very familiar with, that I'm sure some of your listeners know, of King and Heschel with their arms linked as they're walking on together on the Selma to Montgomery march. And to me, it was always a defining moment of two men, one black, one white, a minister, a rabbi, being able to come together to lead this march. And I was, you know, thinking of different ways to come at the story, and I remembered this picture, and I knew that I wanted to write about that event. So I really started with that march, and then because it's a children's book and because, to me, to get to that moment, what was interesting to me was how these men grew up and what led them to be able to come together in this way. So I started researching both of their childhoods, and the more I did so, the more I was kind of astounded by the similarities between the both of them. Martin Luther King's father was a minister. Abraham Joshua Heschel's father was a rabbi. They both were very influenced by their fathers. They both had very loving mothers. They were both discriminated against as children and would go to their families to kind of soothe them at the time. The book starts with the phrase, "Martin was mad at everyone." And Martin was often angry as a boy. He was angry in this case because it was hot in Georgia, and Martin wanted to swim in the pool, but the sign said whites only. So it goes on to talk about, you know, his anger as a boy and how his father counseled him and tried to get him to look beyond that anger.
And his father said something very beautiful to him, or at least you have those words in his father's mouth. You know, Martin comes home, he's angry, he's stepping on bugs in his anger. And what does his father say
to him? He's kind of stomping his feet, he's so angry. And his dad says, "What good is stepping on bugs? You're looking down when you should be looking up."
Right.
And that was the sort of message that that his dad gave him. You know, Martin was very proud of his father, you know, and his message, as I talk about in this book, was really a bringing together of some of the things his father used to say to him with some of the things that his mother used to say to him. And in that sense, you know, Martin kind of combined those two, the advice of both of them, and created this wonderful movement that affected many, many people and, you know, the country and the world.
And were these things that you actually found among the memoirs? I mean, are these true things that the parents said to him?
Yes.
To them?
You know, it's kind of a story. It's fictionalized in some sense, but the words are Martin's words, his parents' words. You know, his mom used to tell him, you know, "Some ignorant white people think they are better than colored people. Don't you ever forget that you are just as good as anybody." You know, the words are there. I created a story around them.
Those words Martin's mother said to him parallel the words that Abraham's father said to him. "We are all God's children. You're as good as anybody." Tell us the circumstances of Abraham Joshua Heschel's life as a child.
Well, I mean, Abraham was a brilliant child. One of these kids that was reading and commentating on the holy books that his father would bring home at a very, very early age. Most people assumed, even when he was, you know, 6 or 7 or 8, people were already asking him advice and coming to him and assuming that he would take over his father's position. As it was, he was considered a brilliant young man. He knew all the Jewish laws and customs, but his father, while he was very proud of Abraham, always made sure that he was grounded. And you know, his father lived on donations from his congregation, and every week after they put aside what the very meager amount the family needed to live on, he would have Abraham pass out what was left of their coins to people who were in worse need. And, you know, that was always, you know, a statement that his dad would always say is, "I hate poverty, but I love the poor." We can always find someone in greater need than ourselves. And he would hide candies in the prayer books when Abraham was very young, because he wanted to teach him that learning is a sweet delight.
And that is a custom that is common.
That is an old Jewish custom.
That's right.
That really tried to get the kids to associate learning
with sweetness.
As it was, you know, Abraham didn't follow the very traditional path. He wrote poetry, and in fact, there have been a couple of books of his poems published. He really had a great breadth of knowledge as far as secular literature as well, but he used his great knowledge in, you know, the service of what he felt was the good for all people. One thing that he said that has always been very important to me, let me see if I can find, he used to tell his friends, words must be followed by deeds. It was not enough for him to preach on the Bema and talk about his philosophy and Judaism, but it was very important, he felt, to actually act as well.
You're listening to Writer's Voice. We're talking to Richard Michelson about his latest book for children, As Good as Anybody. It's a story of how Martin Luther King and Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel came together in Selma, Alabama, to march for freedom and justice. The family suffered terribly during the Holocaust. Tell us what happened just very briefly, and then how did Abraham Joshua Heschel, Rabbi Heschel, come to the United States?
Well, Heschel had been studying at a university in Germany, and there was a knock on his door. He was actually a brilliant student, as to be expected, but as the laws got worse and worse, and as discrimination got more and more, he found that some of his teachers were afraid to give him the degree towards the end. And then he got a knock on the door from the German police telling him that he had 24 hours to leave Germany. He did go home to Warsaw, and he could not find employment. Most businesses had signs in the window, no Jews allowed. Things got worse and worse, and Abraham felt that in order to help his family and maybe send some money back home, he would travel to America, where he had heard that things were better, that there was less discrimination, and he'd be able to find a job. He did travel to America, but on his way over, and right after he got here, of course, things got very, very bad in Europe, and in fact, most members of his family were killed in that time.
You just said before that he would say that words must be followed with deeds. So how did he become then, how did he put that into action in his life once he got here?
He traveled around the country speaking out for equal rights, and he was always on the forefront. Most people know Heschel as he was one of the major voices against the Vietnam War. He took a lot of heat from that by other religious figures and other people in Judaism, but he wrote voluminously and very strongly against the war. Many people condemned him for being that involved. They felt that his job was to be on the Bema and deliver his sermons.
On the Bema, could you explain?
Well,
what
yeah,
that is?
It's like on the pulpit, I would say. You know, but Rabbi Heschel felt that words had to be followed by deeds. It was around that time that he found out, or after he came to America, he found out that many Negroes were not being allowed to vote, and he had to make a decision whether to speak out or not. He was again advised by many people within his own religion not to speak out. Martin Luther King had been turned back on the Voting Rights March from Selma to Montgomery. Many of us know that you know, those famous pictures of the dogs and the police clubbing the blacks as they started their march.
And Martin Luther King was also criticized on the same grounds for his opposition to the war.
Very much so. And that is how the two men first found out about each other. And when Martin Luther King put out a call for help, because he was continuing, I think it was his third attempt to march from Selma to Montgomery. And Heschel, of course, thinking back on his own family in Europe and how other people did not come to their aid, knew that he had to step up to the plate. As he said again, famously, how can we love our neighbors if we abandon them in their time of need? And so he felt that, you know, it was very important to him, and it was important to him because of his faith. Those Jews who are familiar with Heschel, and even when I travel around, generally, even in synagogues, most of the kids know King. Very few of them know Heschel. But those that do know him as a political activist. But it was very important to Heschel that his actions be interpreted in the view of his religion.
And you end with him marching with Martin Luther King in Selma, and he says, Abraham says, "This too is God's work. I feel like my legs are praying."
Isn't that a lovely speech? You know, I was fortunate in this book is that it harkens back to a time when these religious figures and political figures wrote their own words and wrote beautifully. Both of them were very literate men, very well schooled. And we haven't had that, of course, in this country for some time. And we're about to have that again with a leader who actually writes and reads.
That's right. Speaking about their eloquence, I love the two quotes that you have in the beginning of the book, because they not only express that eloquence and also expresses their philosophy, but the words of each one, Martin Luther King and Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, honor the other's people. So I wonder if you could read first Reverend Martin Luther King Jr.'s quote that you have in the front of the book, and then Rabbi Heschel's.
I would be happy to. This is Reverend King speaking. "I solemnly pledge to uphold the fair name of Jews, not only because we need their friendship, and surely we do, but mainly because bigotry in any form is an affront to us all." And I followed that with one of my favorite quotes from Rabbi Heschel, saying, "100 years ago, the emancipation was proclaimed. It is time for the white man to strive for self-emancipation, to set himself free of bigotry."
And that says it right there. On this week, celebrating Martin Luther King Day and also getting ready for the inauguration of the first African-American president, I want to thank you so much, Richard Michelson, for this latest children's book of yours, As Good as Anybody, Martin Luther King Jr. and Abraham Joshua Heschel's Amazing March Toward Freedom. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Poet and children's book author Richard Michelson. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net for more about today's shows. You'll find links to more information, web-only features, and you can sign up for our podcast and get connected on Twitter and Facebook. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.